You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 15th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, senior correspondent at Vox, Ian Millhiser, on Amy Coney Barrett and the future of the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, as the Senate blocks real relief, the Republicans plot to undermine a potential Biden presidency. Meanwhile, 8 million have slipped into poverty following the end of federal aid. And tonight we have dueling town halls as NBC platforms Trump despite his avoiding a debate. Joe Biden has a double-digit lead nationally, but swing state registrations should have you concerned. Federal judge strikes down a Tennessee abortion obstruction law. We'll see how long stuff like that lasts in the new SCOTUS era. Meanwhile, another federal judge says North Carolina absentee ballots will need witness signatures. While another federal judge gives Virginia an extension on registration because of that fiber cable cut. Desperate Biden smear falls apart and crashes on its launch pad, but raises the problems with the size and dominance of social media platforms. New CDC report, masks and closures led to a 75% decrease, in Arizona's coronavirus cases. Xi Jinping tells its military to prepare for war in advance of a Trump plan to sell weapons to Taiwan. Things are getting even more hairy on the Armenia-Azerbaijan border. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Hope all is well. Thank you for joining us today. Today is the final day of the Supreme Court hearings, and there'll be no testimony from Amy Coney Barrett. She was going to say answered all of her questions over the past 2 days, but I should say she did not answer all of her questions and finished yesterday. I mean, some of the questions that she refused to answer were quite stunning. And we'll talk to Ian Millhiser about the Democratic strategy of actually attending these hearings and whether it was worth it. Today, this morning, there was old business, I guess, for the Judiciary Committee, or I'm not exactly sure what the parliamentary, but there were moments where we heard various sides talk about the process in general, and then they moved on to the questioning of witnesses who were testifying on behalf or against the nomination. Sheldon Whitehouse has really impressed me in these hearings. Yesterday, I had mentioned that he did a long, extended run on the case of Friedrich and Janus, which both very important cases. Janus, obviously, more so because it was, in fact, adjudicated by the Supreme Court. Friedrich was not because of the death of Scalia. Very important cases in terms of material implications on our society and unions, but also a great way to understand the process of the Supreme Court. And if I have time, I will play the entire 6-minute clip at the end of this hour today and walk you through it, because I think it's that important for people to be aware and have an awareness of the Supreme Court. And then White House this morning said, you guys, pointing to the Republicans, your credibility is shot. We're not going to do this thing where Democrats play by the rules and you guys don't anymore. When you come to us complaining that we're changing the rules later, remember this moment. I hope there were other members of that committee and on the Democratic side that heard that. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is going to be doing a town hall tonight at 8 p.m. Now, Joe Biden was scheduled to do a town hall at 8 p.m. on ABC because he was supposed to be doing a debate that Donald Trump did not end up showing up for. And then NBC apparently offered Donald Trump the exact same slot. So we'll talk more about that later in the program. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know if I would indulge the ratings for that myself. But here is Donald Trump. He is on the campaign trail. He's going around doing his rallies again. And he's got a lot of energy. Boy, oh boy, I wish I had that kind of energy. I'll tell you what, if you could bottle that kind of energy. Anyways, here he is. Here is his closing argument, I guess, in this rally. Not of the rally, but this is what we call, with 2.5 weeks left of an election, you start getting into the closing argument. Why should we vote for Donald Trump?
It's time to focus.
You hear the news? Bruce Orr is finally out of the Department of Justice. Bruce Orr. Him and his wonderful wife, Molly. She wrote all this stuff, and then he goes and he works at the Department of Justice, and he took it. Didn't he bring it to the FBI? The wife writes it. She gets paid a lot of money. Bruce Orr is finally out of the Department of Justice. That's good. A couple of years too late, that's all.
Pause it. Pause it for a second. I follow this stuff professionally. I have no idea who Bruce Orr is. Have you ever heard of me? Have you ever even come across the name Bruce Orr?
It sounds like a hockey player.
I mean, I feel like this is something, if I followed the DOJ closely, I would know who Bruce Orr. But I mean, well, Bobby Orr was a very prestigious hockey player for the Bruins. He was one of the best. But I don't think that's the same guy. Bobby Orr would be significantly older at this point. Google Bruce Orr. They got people applauding. Bruce Orr is finally out of the DOJ. This is my closing argument, ladies and gentlemen. Google Bruce Orr. Let's see what we got. Bruce Orr News, Levon Adams Orr Obituary, Inside Innovation, The Effect of Analytical Strategies. Oh, the CEO of ProNorris or whatever it is. I don't think Lakeside Fishing makes a splash. Wait, there it is. 4 weeks ago, another ex-Trumpers voting for Biden. Here's why. And then Bruce Orr is like the third name after Strzok and Lisa Page. And then there's somebody who wrote a book about a female serial killer that wasn't. Another obituary. Kareem Orr, that's a, I don't know, I guess maybe it looks like a football player. Then a Twilight competition set for Bulls. Who is he talking about? And how are so many people applauding that Bruce Orr doesn't have a job anymore?
Woo!
And poor Mary. It's a very odd closing argument. Continue, though, because he wants to bring up this this supposed story in the New York Post about Burisma again, except for he has trouble doing it.
The Department of Justice. That's good. Couple of years too late, that's all. He should be not only in the Department of Justice outbox, he should be someplace else, okay? 8 months after his alleged meeting with the Burmese executives. So this Burmese, they say, pronounce it Burmese.
Burmese, what? They were basing his whole campaign on Burisma, and he can't even say the word now? What is going on with this guy? He has a lot of energy, but he doesn't seem to have full control of his mouth.
I done a little bit of digging, and it looks like the Bruce Orr mentioned in the Independent is maybe a wrong spelling, or here's a different Bruce Orr. This is the one he's talking about, it looks like. O-H-R. So oh. I've never heard of this guy, but he's linked to the Steele dossier, apparently.
Oh, I see.
So, Bruce Orr.
Finally, Bruce Orr is out. Wow.
So we have to update the spelling on our upcoming Bruce Orr t-shirts.
Well, then we got to do that again. I mean, there it is. There's your closing argument from the President of the United States. Bruce Orr is collecting unemployment. So you won't have Bruce Orr to kick around anymore. Let's do this one more clip of Amy Coney Barrett. This was, and we will, I'm going to really try and get to this Sheldon Whitehouse at the end of this. If not, maybe I'll do it tomorrow because I think it's really important. But I get the sense that she did not know one of the cases he was talking about. It's a famous precedent. And, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, she is, by all accounts, a good law professor. Funny, we don't hear that so much because that was a big problem with Barack Obama. But nevertheless, here she is. They were bragging about how she had no notes. No notes. Well, it looks like maybe she should have brought one note. This is when she's asked about the First Amendment. And to be fair, you know, we did it here and we could only get four as well. Now, we are not law professors.
What are the five freedoms of the First Amendment?
Speech, religion, press, assembly, speech, press, religion, assembly. I don't know. What am I missing?
Redress or protest.
Okay.
That's when you have the right to, you know, I guess, petition your government, get them to change what they're doing in some fashion. I don't know. I thought that was pretty funny. I mean, obviously, we know where he's going with that. That is about religion. That is going to be the hallmark, I think, of Amy Barrett, Coney Barrett's judicial career will be how many things, how many rights other people have will be abridged because of the religion of other people. But you don't need to take my word for it. We're going to take just a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent at Vox, who writes on the Supreme Court and other legal matters. We'll be back in just a moment. We are back. Welcome to the program, or I should say returning to the program, Ian Millhiser. He is the senior correspondent from Vox. What is your official title, Ian?
Yeah, senior correspondent at Vox.
All right, so senior correspondent at Vox and writing on the Supreme Court. Thank you so much for joining us. I know on days like this, you are in a big demand and a very busy. Well, broadly speaking, and maybe it's not relevant on, you know, in terms of like what's going to happen next.
Right.
But give me your sense of these hearings over the past couple of days, or maybe we can even start with the premise, like, should Democrats have even attended these hearings?
Right. So, I mean, these hearings are normally fairly useless affairs, and this was a particularly useless hearing. I think that nominees have gotten better and better at sucking all the information out of the room. And Amy Coney Barrett is a genius at that. I mean, I have never seen a nominee do a better job at not disclosing things than Amy Coney Barrett. Now, that said, like, there's not a lot of mystery here. Like, you know, Democrats spent a lot of time trying to trick her into saying that she would overrule Roe v. Wade, and they didn't. But she has pledged to oppose abortion rights. And she signed a statement saying that Roe v. Wade was an infamous decision. So, like, the mystery of how she's going to vote on Roe has kind of already been solved. You know, there was a lot of that dancing around Obamacare, trying to get her to say something about what she thinks about that. But she's already criticized the previous two decisions preserving most of the Affordable Care Act. So the hearings revealed very little. I mean, I don't know that there was any point to them at all. And, you know, I would have been just fine not having to spend the last 2 days of my life watching them. But there's also, you know, we also already know a great deal of useful information about this nominee.
Well, I guess why I'm asking is from as a political matter, because, you know, we're going to get to talking about, like, you know, what your sense is as to what Democrats should do.
Yeah.
But as a political matter, dealing with reformation of the court, if the Democrats are in a position to do it later, it seems to me there was a tough sell for them at the beginning, which is these hearings are a sham.
Right.
On a process level. I mean, it seems to me like if you're faced with a sham, what you do is you don't participate. That's how you indicate that it's a sham. What's your sense of that?
So my sense of the Democrats' strategy here, and this isn't so much from, like, you know, talking with individual senators, but just from the outside looking in, like, Democrats are winning this election right now. Like, if you look at the polls, Joe Biden is more than 10 points up over Trump. And so I think that the way that Democrats went into this is they were probably thinking, look, right now the status quo in this election favors us. We can make a big deal about Amy Coney Barrett and, like, maybe that helps us, but it's not in our interest to create waves. Like we don't want to change the conversation in the country. We don't want the voters to be paying attention to something else. We want them to keep paying attention to whatever it is they're paying attention to that gets Joe Biden to stay up by 10 points. And in the long run, I mean, if we want to jump ahead a few steps, I think that Democrats are going to need to pack the Supreme Court in order to deal with the very partisan majority that it's going to have. But given the choice between Democrats winning a messaging fight right now, where they really get a lot of people angry about Amy Coney Barrett and performing really well in the elections, you know, Democrats are better off having 54 Senate seats and losing a messaging fight than they are having 52 Senate seats and winning a messaging fight.
I think that's a valid point. Let me ask you this, though. Do you think there is a sufficient desire, energy, willingness on the part of Democrats with those 54 Senate seats? And I'm going to circle back to some of these issues that we can expect in terms of Amy Coney Barrett. But I think, you know, since we got here so quickly, we should deal with this. Do you think there is the sentiment, assuming it's 54, whatever the number is, there is the sentiment, and maybe it just comes from Joe Biden at that point, to expand the size of the court? And I guess my sense is that messaging war about Amy Coney Barrett now is not so much about the election that it, and I think your point is well taken, that could maybe implicate the election, but is to create a sense of outrage that will carry through to that potential future of 54 senators, to create a sense of, like, you need to do something about this Amy Coney Barrett thing. I mean, it's very hard to go back and say, hey, remember that thing that happened four months ago? That was an outrage. And we're really outraged about it now. And now we're going to have to expand the Supreme Court. I mean, if you don't set the marker contemporaneously, it's sort of hard to go back and say, hey, remember? Well, we were really outraged. We just didn't let you know about it at the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the missing piece here and, like, the procedural, like, I think that Senate Democrats are very angry about Republicans, you know, saying one thing when it was Merrick Garland and then doing the other when it's Amy Coney Barrett, like pretending that there's a rule that people can't be confirmed in an election year under Obama. And then, like, ha ha ha, jokes on you when it's Trump. I think there's a lot of anger. I don't think, you know, and some of this comes from talking to Capitol Hill sources, that Democrats have really coalesced around a particular solution. And I think it's hard generally to build outrage, you know, both amongst senators and amongst the grassroots over what's essentially a procedural objection. Like, I mean, there just aren't that many voters out there who are going to get outraged over, you know, they changed what they were saying about when it's appropriate to have a Supreme Court confirmation fight. And like that's just a hard sell. So I think the missing piece here is that there needs to be an outrage, like, you know, and a substantive outrage. And the Supreme Court needs to strike down the Affordable Care Act. It needs to neuter the Voting Rights Act, which is something that is very much on the table this term. It needs to, you know, potentially overrule Roe v. Wade. Like, it has to do something substantive that enrages not just Senate Democrats, but Democrats in the base. And when that happens, I think there's a real chance that there's a court packing fight. The danger, I think, for Democrats is that John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh are both very savvy political operators. I mean, you wouldn't have known it from Kavanaugh's behavior in his confirmation hearing, but
well,
like,
I asked the moms and they told me.
Right. But, you know, like Kavanaugh was he served in a very senior role in the Bush White House. I mean, he knows how politics works. And I think there's a real danger that if Democrats do very well in the 2020 election, the Supreme Court kind of cools its heels for 2 years.
Like, yes.
Doesn't do anything crazy, certainly doesn't strike down the Voting Rights Act. And then if Republicans take back the Senate in 2020, then they can start doing things like manipulating our election law in ways that make it very hard for Democrats to win elections. And Democrats at that point will want to pack the court, but they won't have the votes because Republicans will control at least one house of Congress.
Well, let's just talk. Let's touch on one of those things, because I agree with the sort of like the timeline you're sort of and the sequencing of this stuff. On day one, I would imagine the Democrats, if they are in the majority in all the houses, and let's for a moment assume that at one point they may have to get rid of the filibuster in the Senate on legislation. But I think they're going to pass a fix to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
I think that's likely if they have the votes. Yeah.
And this was struck down by the court. I think it was in 2013. And it basically said there are, I think it was 16 states or multiple counties that need to check with the Department of Justice before they change their voting laws in any way, because they had a history of racism, essentially, when it came to elections, that they would disenfranchise minorities. And the Supreme Court, despite the fact that it had been reauthorized by the Senate, said racism's more or less over. This is not a fair way to do it. We don't have a problem with the concept of preclearance. We just have a problem with the way you're calculating it.
Yeah.
And so go back and recalculate it in some way. Come up with a different algorithm, I guess, for how a state gets needs preclearance or a county. And so the Democrats pass it. How long does that take before it's challenged, so that we can get one of those material sort of incidents, catalysts that you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, the answer is that the courts, if they want to delay a reckoning on this, have plenty of tools that they can use to do that. I mean, Democrats, like, if we're imagining a world where there's, say, 54 Democratic senators and they nuke the filibuster, Democrats have some really smart, aggressive plans on voting rights. There's the By the People Act, which really would be the most aggressive voting rights legislation ever enacted by the United States Congress. I mean, deals with gerrymandering, deals with public financing of elections, you know, deals with things like voter ID that are just there to suppress the vote. I mean, just a really well thought out comprehensive law. There's a companion bill, H.R. 4, which is named after John Lewis, which is the Voting Rights Act fix. And in many ways, the Voting Rights Act fixes in H.R. 4 would make the Voting Rights Act more potent than it was before Shelby County, because it would make it easier to do what's called a bail-in. So like the way that the Voting Rights Act worked originally is that states with a history of racist voting behavior had to pre-clear new voting laws with officials in Washington, D.C. And there was a process where a state that had not in the past been subject to preclearance, if they did a bunch of racist stuff, could be bailed in and subjected to preclearance. This law would make it much easier to bail in states. So you could see states like Wisconsin, that under Scott Walker did a lot of really racist stuff, could wind up potentially being subject to preclearance. And then there's statehood. So like DC statehood is something that Democrats have said they want to do. I think Puerto Rican statehood is potentially on the table. And that would help to deal with the problem of Senate malapportionment, where Republicans effectively get extra right. seats in the Senate. So Democrats have a lot of big plans. I think that all of these things could potentially be struck down or at least like neutered by a Supreme Court that was sufficiently hostile to voting rights. And there's a real danger of that happening. If it were to happen, I mean, with Obamacare, you know, President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act in 2010. And the first major challenge to it didn't reach the justices until 2012. Right.
But it wasn't enacted until 2014 anyways. So, but I guess the point being that if they want to avoid a confrontation that could function as a catalyst for reform of the Supreme Court, they can do it for at least 2 years.
Yes. And I mean, I think that 2 years would be the ordinary process for like, you know, like it wasn't like anyone dragged their feet in the Obamacare litigation. Right. Like, I mean, it just went through the normal process and it took about 2 years to reach the justices. If the justices want to delay things, there's lots of things they can do. Like they can say that, oh, like, we don't think there's a sufficiently developed record in this case. Let's send it down to the district court to like screw around for another 6 months before it comes back up. Like there are lots of things that the Supreme Court can do if its goal is to make sure that it doesn't rule until there is a Republican majority in the Senate.
Okay. So with that said, that's the fix scenario, I guess, on some level. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about the highly problematic scenario that we are now faced with, in all likelihood, by election day, it appears, yeah. we're going to have a 6-3 majority conservative court. You and I have talked for a long time. There was, I think, and I'm going to try and play this clip later in the program, but Sheldon Whitehouse did what I thought was an amazing job of walking through the Janus saga, as he right. called it. And I feel like to a certain extent, frankly, that you have done that for me on a multitude of cases, including that one probably over the years. And one of those is you have been talking about for a long time is a return to the Lochner era. Mm-hmm. Let me let you sort of define for us what are going to be the implications before we even can contemplate a fix. Yeah. of an Amy Coney Barrett. I mean, I think people understand the hostility to Roe v. Wade and the ways in which they could start to allow more and more trap laws. These are laws that just basically put up obstacles and make Roe v. Wade effectively overturned, if not directly overturned, in practice overturned. What are some of the other ways that it's going to affect Americans on a daily basis?
Yeah, so I actually have a book coming out early next year that goes into this. And so realistically, I think there's four areas that we need to worry about. The biggest one is voting rights. I mean, this is a Supreme Court that's already very hostile to the Voting Rights Act. The most recent court decisions on voting rights, like there's a case out of South Carolina recently. What the court has basically signaled is that it takes a posture of indifference towards voting rights. So like, you know, Kavanaugh and Roberts, I don't think that their position has been that they're just going to make sure the Republicans win in every case, no matter what. Their position has been states can do whatever the hell they want. So if California wants to have really robust voting rights, that's fine. And if South Carolina wants to put in a bunch of unnecessary obstacles for voters who are trying to cast ballots, that's fine too. And I think that posture, that's what we're likely to see, on top of the fact that while the Supreme Court is telling the states they can do whatever that they want to do, the Supreme Court's going to make it very hard for Congress to pass laws like the Voting Rights Act. So it's going to make it very hard for the federal government to intervene and prevent states from doing that.
Almost as if they're saying there is an absence of a federal right to vote. Like there is no to say on the Supreme Court level, the concept, it's almost as if the concept of a voting right does not exist. It only exists if a state decides to give it to you.
Right. I mean, this is actually worse than that, which is that it's one thing to say that the Constitution doesn't protect a right to vote. What the Supreme Court did in cases like Shelby County and Abbott v. Perez, which weakened much of the Voting Rights Act, is it says not only are we not going to say that the Constitution protects the right to vote here, but if the Congress, if the duly elected federal legislature enacts a law saying there shall be these protections for voting rights, we're going to strike them down.
We're not even going to allow for a federal right to vote.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I don't know if they'll necessarily strike down every single Voting Rights Act that you can, voting rights law that you can conceive of, but they've already been very aggressive. And so the biggest thing, I said there are four things I'm worried about. The biggest thing that I'm worried about is voting rights, because without voting rights, you have nothing.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter.
You don't have the mechanism in which to deal with any of this.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Like without voting rights, the laws are just going to be whatever the people in power want them to be. And you can't hold them accountable. So that's the first issue that worries me. The second issue is the administrative state, which sounds like super technical. But the issue there is a lot of laws, like the Clean Air Act, for example, doesn't say, here's how you have to operate a power plant. It says, we want to make sure that power plants use the best available technology, taking into account factors like cost, in order to reduce emissions. And we know that over time, there's going to be better technology. And so, like, we're going to want to change what you have to use over time as better technology emerges. And so it's the job of the EPA to study what sort of technology is out there and to update the rules that power plants have to follow as new technology emerges. And there's just a lot of laws that work this
and
way.
And this is the concept of delegation.
Exactly. And so there's this thing called the non-delegation doctrine that, like, Gorsuch in particular is particularly jazzed up about. And there are already five votes, it appears, to revive the non-delegation doctrine. The non-delegation doctrine, in effect, gives the Supreme Court a veto over any federal regulation. So, like, the Supreme Court doesn't like what the EPA has done with power plants, the Supreme Court can veto it. The Supreme Court doesn't like that the Department of Health and Human Services have said that health plans have to cover birth control. And this came up recently in the Little Sisters case. The Supreme Court can veto it. The Supreme Court doesn't like that the Obama administration wants to make sure that more people are paid overtime. Supreme Court can veto it.
So, and just to be clear, once the Supreme Court says that, and this sort of dovetails with the Chevron deference, which is where the court, defers to the expertise of these agencies in handling these type of issues. But once the court says that we have this non-delegation doctrine, the Supreme Court, that sends the messages to the federal circuit courts.
Right.
Right. Some of which are significantly more conservative than others, depending on the region,
right?
Very often. And they can start to strike down these laws.
Exactly.
And because they are doing so under the umbrella of this non-delegation principle that the Supreme Court has established. So it's basically open season where anything from like CAFE standards on cars to requirements for chicken processing plants for, drug safety. I mean,
OSHA standards, workplace safety. Yeah.
On the table at that point and up to the whims of some of the most conservative justices. And we should remind people 200 and some odd, I think we're at 15 now, of those judges appointed during the Trump era.
Right. Yeah, like basically what we're talking about is a huge transfer of power from the president and the executive branch to the judicial branch. And like, I mean, obviously, I'm not too jazzed about the president we have right now. But one thing that I like about the president is you can vote them out of office.
Right.
And, so the Supreme Court has already been pretty clear, even before Barrett, that it wants to bring back this non-delegation doctrine. The reason why Barrett matters is because the more conservative the court gets, the more often it's going to use its veto power. Like, there may be some regulations that John Roberts would say, you know, like, that's fine. Like, I will let this rule saying that you have to have some, like, protection in meatpacking plants that prevents people from getting their fingers cut off still survive. And if Roberts is no longer the swing vote, like, maybe you won't have that anymore.
Right.
So that's the second thing, administrative law. Third thing is religion. And in the religion space, like, the big issue is basically whether people who have a religious objection to following a particular law are allowed to just ignore that law. You know, the most common example, like the big fight right now, and there's a case in front of the Supreme Court that will be heard next month dealing with this, is whether people with religious objections to gay people or to trans people are allowed to discriminate against them, even when the law says that that discrimination is illegal. But like, these lawsuits aren't going to stop with LGBT people. Like, you know, I think the Supreme Court is likely to say that there is a constitutional right for religious people to discriminate against LGBT people. And like, someone's going to come along and say, well, you know, I believe in the so-called Billy Graham rule, you know, the Pence rule, that I shouldn't be alone with a woman who's not my wife. And so the fact that I give all these job opportunities to my male employees because they get to meet with me, and I don't give it to my female employees because they never get any FaceTime with me because of my religion. Like, you can't enforce the ban on gender discrimination against me. You know, you could potentially see suits, although, like, at least some justices have signaled that, like, they think race discrimination goes too far. But, like, you could potentially see something like the Bob Jones University case being right. reopened, which was the case where a university claimed that it had a religious right to forbid its white students from dating its black students.
And we should say that that case we've talked about in the past, not in the context of its legal implications, but that was considered to be the seminal moment where the religious right in this country started to organize with the Republican Party. They couldn't get people on board for that. That had to do with Jimmy Carter and the taxation of that school subject to a tax exemption. And they ended up deciding on abortion as the issue that could motivate their voters, who up until that point were sort of more of the attitude, leave unto Caesar, you know, Caesar's realm, as it were. But this, and I mean, frankly, I mean, It doesn't seem terribly inconsistent. Like, my religion feels that you shouldn't intermarry between races, and so therefore I'm not going to rent my any of my apartments in my building that I own as a religious person to any mixed race couple. I just don't think it's what God wanted. I mean, theoretically, right? That's what it opens the door to.
Right. I mean,
I don't know what the limiting principle is at that point.
Yeah, I mean, the limiting principle is, like, whatever the justices like, if the justices think that the law is sufficiently important that religious people should have to follow it, then they'll have to follow it. And if the justices, like, just don't think it's important. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the older cases, there was an older case that said that it doesn't matter that you have a religious objection to Social Security taxes. You still have to pay them. I mean, potentially that could be reversed. There was a case involving people who said they had a religious objection to paying their workers the minimum wage. And the Supreme Court said you have to pay them the minimum wage. I mean, potentially that could be reversed.
I've told that for everybody working here that my God says, when I'm not supposed to do that. But
Yeah. So, you know, if in fact, you know, people gain exemptions to the law, I mean, like, conceivably, like, you know, I get a speeding ticket, or like, I run a red light and I say to the cop, well, I'm late to church, and like, my religion tells me I can't be late to church, so you can't give me a ticket. Like, does that mean that I'm immune to speeding laws? I mean, the answer is we don't know. It depends right. whether whatever the Supreme Court says.
Okay. And that's the third one. What's the fourth?
Then the fourth is the question of who is allowed to enforce their rights in the first place. And this is an area where the Supreme Court has already been very aggressive. The biggest place where you see this is what's called forced arbitration cases. So this is when, like, you know, you're doing your job and, like, You know, and everything seems cool. And then all of a sudden you get an email from your boss that says, as of this moment, you are bound by a forced arbitration clause. If you ever have a lawsuit against the company, you're not allowed to go to a real court. You have to go to a privatized arbitration system. You're forbidden from bringing a class action suit. And if you don't like it, you're fired. So this is something the Supreme Court has already said is allowed. And so what happens is, I mean, we have data on this. In the employment context, employees are much less likely to win in front of an arbitrator. And when they do win, they receive a whole lot less money.
Right.
So this just gives companies, you know, all of a sudden, like, you know, let's say that, you know, you believe that you were fired because you are Black. You know, if you go to a real court, you have a good chance of winning, and your lawyer tells you, you know, you could maybe collect $100,000. If you go to an arbitrator, you have a much smaller chance of winning, and your lawyer says, you know, well, if you win, you're probably going to get $20,000. First of all, you're not going to get a very good, you may not get a very good lawyer under those circumstances, because a lot of lawyers work on a contingency basis where they get a percentage of the winnings. But even if, you know, you don't have that problem, you know, you're going to start thinking like, you know, this is a huge hassle. And yeah. Like, do I want to get a reputation when I'm applying for my next job as the person who sued my previous employer? If the amount of money on the table is only $20,000 and not $100,000. So like these sorts of things can effectively strip people of their ability to enforce their rights.
It's the creation of an entirely parallel judicial system that is privatized.
Yes.
And works with the same privatized incentive as anything else. I mean, the arbitrators, they know that that one guy you're talking about, he's not going to show up very often, and he's not the one who's going to be paying their bills. He knows that the company, the major corporation, they're going to be paying our bills. So we want to be the arbitration for them. I mean, there's so many problems with that, the access to our judicial system. And then, of course, it also changes the behavior of the corporations. If they know that there is a disincentive for anybody that they have wronged in that way to come and try and get money from them in the future, then their behavior is going to reflect that lack of, I guess, a threat to them.
Right. So, yeah. So in like the real court system, there are all sorts of rules dealing with what are called personal jurisdiction and venue, which are essentially the rules governing which court you're allowed to sue in if you have a dispute. And they aren't airtight. Like there's a lot of what is called forum shopping, where like lawyers will shop around for judges that they think will be favorable to their client. But there's limits to forum shopping. Like, you know, Vox Media, my employer is a DC-based company. And if I have a grievance against them, you know, I could probably file in DC because that's where they're based. Like right now, I live in Northern Virginia and I'm doing a lot of work in Virginia. I could probably sue in a Virginia court. But if I was like, hey, there's this judge out in Nebraska who I think is going to rule in my favor, I'd have a real tough time making an argument that I can go to Nebraska. But in the arbitration system, typically when you get this forced arbitration contract, it doesn't just say, you know, you're stuck in arbitration, you can't bring a class action and so on and so forth. It names the company that will perform the arbitration. And so, you know, the company is going to know the corporation that writes that contract is going to know more about those companies than the plaintiffs are. Right. It's going to get to pick them. And then, like you said, the arbitrators know. I mean, big employers are sued all the time, so they are repeat players. Individuals, you know, I've never been a party to a lawsuit in my life. Most people haven't. And so if you're the arbitration company, you know, what's got to be going on in the back of your mind is like, you know, if I do a solid for this employee, they're never going to see me again. If I do a solid for this corporation, they're going to continue to pay my bills.
Right, right, right. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, it's sort of the same problem we had with the rating agencies. So, and I mean, this is going to happen. We're going to start to see this change. I mean, but the problem is it's a little bit opaque, right? I mean, but for your average person, we're going to start to see this change 2 weeks from now or whatever. I mean, with the 6-3 court, aren't we?
I mean, we won't know that that something has changed right away because it takes a while for cases to percolate. But yeah, I mean, this is going to, I mean, absent court packing, you know, absent Democrats doing something to change the makeup of the Supreme Court, this is going to be locked in for a really long time. And, you know, with a 6-3 majority, you know, we're basically relying on Brett Kavanaugh to be the to be the voice of reason. Like, you know, for 2 years, John Roberts has been the guy who, like, every now and then looked at what his Republican colleagues wanted to do. Was like, hey, guys, that's a bit too much. And like the next most moderate justice is Brett Kavanaugh. And like, just stop and think about that for a second. I mean, if you want to know where the difference between Brett Kavanaugh and the other justices in the South Carolina case that I brought up,
that's the witness. You need a witness for signing the ballots, which, exactly. Of course, in North Carolina, they've just imposed that, probably based upon that ruling that happened in South Carolina.
Yeah. So there's, you know, in South Carolina, there's this requirement that you have to get a witness to sign your absentee ballot, which ordinarily isn't a big deal. But in a pandemic, I mean, right, there are people who may not want, you know, be able to talk to their neighbors. So what happened in that case, the Supreme Court reinstated the witness requirement. Kavanaugh's opinion basically said, we're completely indifferent to voting rights. States, go do what you want. Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch said not only would they reinstate the witness requirements, but they would also toss out all the ballots that had already been cast by people who didn't get a witness during the period when there was a court order in place saying they didn't need a witness.
Wow.
So like the difference between, say, a Gorsuch and a Kavanaugh is Kavanaugh says, I don't care about your rights. And Gorsuch says, I'm going to burn your rights to the ground.
Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent from Vox, always really brightens my day.
I am here to bring uplift and joy, lollipops and love, unicorns and happiness.
I cannot wait for your book, and I hope to speak to you at least before it comes out, and certainly then. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back, and I want to play that that Sheldon Whitehouse clip for you. Quick break. We are back. So I've been talking about this clip. I think Sheldon Whitehouse did a great job on this. And since In for a Penny, In for a Pound, we are going to hear, obviously, tonight from both candidates. ABC News is NBC News head Cesar Conde says, we share in the frustration that our event will initially air alongside the first half of ABC's broadcast with Vice President Biden. Our decision is motivated only by fairness, not business considerations. I'm not sure I understand that concept. It's the American public who are going to lose out here. We got time for this clip. All right. So cue up this clip, Brendan. I'm going to talk over it a little bit and maybe we can cut back to me. This is Sheldon Whitehouse. He has just had this exchange where he is explaining to Amy Coney Barrett, who apparently did not know this. The Supreme Court, there is no code of ethics for the Supreme Court. There is no statutory code of ethics. There are for lower courts. There are for members of Congress. There are members of the administration. Statutory obligations to reveal and be transparent about who's paying you for certain things, what you can and cannot do, how you must recuse yourself. That does not exist for the highest court in the land. And after talking about that, Sheldon Whitehouse, and suggesting that maybe he and Lindsey Graham will offer legislation to that effect, he goes into this. And this is very important. It's a little bit long. I'm going to break it up and explain to you what's going on. But this is very important for you to understand how these cases are going to make it to the Supreme Court now and what's going to happen to so many of the things that we take for granted in our material lives.
You've got that potentially coming your way. So I flagged that for you. The second thing, another topic I'd like to raise with you is you've repeatedly mentioned during this hearing the phrase about litigation winding its way up through the courts and ultimately to the Supreme Court. And you've described that process of winding its way as an important restraint on judicial activism, that you got to wait till a case gets to you in the ordinary course, correct?
Correct.
That's a fair description of where you've been?
Correct.
Yeah, and the...
Oh, what happened? I know we're going a little fast. It's fine. We can keep the sped up. That's fine.
A person, right?
Correct.
And that person feels an injury?
Yes.
And then that person goes to a lawyer?
Yes.
And then that lawyer goes on their behalf to court?
And files a complaint.
And files a complaint.
All right, guys, I'm not seeing any picture. So
in court,
pause it.
They try to
speed it back up. You can speed it back up. I'm not seeing any picture.
Shit. One second. Come on.
Hang in there with us, folks. Just a little bit of technical difficulties. I mean, this is... Senator Whitehouse is basically saying that she has said, you know, this concept of a case winding its way through court, that, you know, someone's wronged, they go to court, it works its way up through the district court and then the circuit court, and it's appealed, and then maybe it makes it to the Supreme Court. It makes it seem like it's happenstance. And Whitehouse is making the argument here that this is not only is it not happenstance, there are concerted efforts to bring about cases. And not only are there concerted efforts to bring about cases, there is a communication between the justices where they are hunting for cases so that they can attack certain doctrines that have existed in our law, in some instances, for decades. Do we have it, Brandon?
Yes.
Okay, let's play it. You can speed it up a little bit. It's fine.
To a lawyer?
Yes.
And then that lawyer goes on their behalf to court?
And files a complaint.
And files a complaint. And then in court, they try to win and vindicate their injury. That's kind of the basic standard way in which this works.
Yes.
So it gets a little weird sometimes. And that's a circumstance I'd like to bring up to you because it touches on some of the stuff that I addressed yesterday. It's not even a case. Let me call, you know, Janice.
Yes.
Okay. Let's describe this as the Janice saga, because it's more than really one case. And it's really about a completely different case called Abood. You're familiar with the Abood decision?
Yes.
So the Abood decision was precedent for what, 40 years?
I can't remember when Abood was decided, but pause it was precedent
it for one
before
second.
Janice.
Yeah. And roughly
I'm going to try and go quick here. We don't have too much time. The idea that she doesn't know exactly how long is very, very odd to me. She may not know about the Abood case. It was from 1977. It was Abood v. Detroit. It basically said that public sector workers, that a union shop, public sector workers can work in a union shop, and even if you're not a member of the union, you still need to pay union agency fees so that that you're paying for them to represent all the workers because they got to pay for lawyers and they do all the negotiating on your behalf. That is Abood. 1977, very famous case. If you tap me on the shoulder and said, when was Abood? I would have said it was probably in the 70s, but she seems not to know that.
40 years, I'll tell you. And had repeatedly been reaffirmed.
It was a longstanding precedent.
Yeah, on which there was considerable reliance.
Let's see. So Janice did overrule that precedent, and so Janice did go through the application of the stare decisis factors in deciding whether to overrule it.
Correct.
Rather that...
And there was, in fact, reliance in the 40 years that it had been the law of the land on the question of the union question that it had resolved.
Well, I don't want to second guess
I don't think she knows what
Abood is. Praise the majority in Janice's
of course there was
I'm
reliance.
Asking you, I'm asking you
unions
as a fact,
collected agency
plus
fees for 40 years based upon this.
Well, Senator, I think reliance and the degree of reliance on Abood
okay.
is a legal question.
We'll just leave that then. So the Janice saga
question.
Begins actually with a case called Knox, in which Justice Alito... took a shot at Abood. He criticized it as substantially impinging upon First Amendment rights of union members. Just for people who are watching, the Abood case was about the right of a labor union to get compensated, not dues, but just compensation from non-members when in their representation of their members, they get added benefits for the people who are not members. So not the most exciting part of the law, but settled this question of when labor unions could get compensated for work they do for non-members. But Justice Alito did not like it. He took a shot at it in Knox versus SEIU, and the concurrence in that case said, whoa, wait a minute. quote, the majority's choice to reach an issue not presented by the parties, briefed or argued, disregards our rules.
Pause it for one second.
I didn't like something about
the point is, Knox was about union dues, not agency fees. And to bring in agency fees in the context of a legal case, you're really stretching. Like this is not at issue here. Supreme Court always deals with stuff that is very narrowly tailored. And to bring this other stuff set off an alarm bell with the people, with the other Supreme Court justices. Why would you bring this up? That's an odd. I mean, it's tangentially related, but it has nothing to do with the disposition of this case. Continue.
So he took that shot. Then we went on to a later decision called Harris v. Quinn. Alito took another shot at Abood in that case, describing Abood as having analysis that is questionable. He undertook an extended critique of the decision, describing it as having questionable foundations. Justice Kagan spotted that, and in her dissent, she said today's majority cannot resist taking pot shots at Abood, and described its critique of Abood's foundations as gratuitous dicta. But the message went out from Judge Alito that he wanted to do something about Abood. There was something about Abood that he did not like. And with that, we went to, that's the prequel. Then we went to the two cases that followed. The first one was Friedrichs, which was supposed to be the case that got rid of Abood. And it had an interesting travel because the lawyer in the case was one of these groups from Janus. It was the Center for Individual Rights right here who was counsel. In Janus, the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation was counsel. So they switched, right? In Friedrichs, Center for Individual Rights was counsel, National Right to Work was an amicus. When it went on to Janus, they switched. National Right to Work Legal Foundation, Defense Foundation was counsel, and Center for Individual Rights was an amicus. And from everything that I see, it looks like they actually went out and found the plaintiff. So back to our earlier discussion, it wasn't the injured person that went and hired a lawyer. It was the legal group that went and found a plaintiff. And then they went to court, which everybody does. But it got interesting there because there the lawyers asked to lose. I don't know if you've ever been in a case in which the lawyers asked to lose before. I never have been. I've never litigated against anybody who asked to lose. Have you ever been in a case in which a party asked to lose?
No, I don't think I've ever experienced that.
Yeah, I can imagine not. So these groups with all this money behind them from Donors Trust and Bradley
okay,
Foundation.
Okay, let's cut out of this liberally because we've got to wrap things up here.
And they say,
but the bottom line is, White House has now shown how Alito called through sort of bringing in another element for cases to come up through the system so that he could attack the right of unions to get paid for their representation of everybody in a shop. And White House is also listing how all of the people representing the plaintiffs in this, all the entities, were basically the same entities. They were getting money from the same places. They would put a different name on who was going to actually litigate the case and who was just going to write an amicus brief, which is basically just a legal work that is put into the argument, sort of basically deputies, if you will, that ostensibly come from outside who might have a thing to say about a case. But in this instance, they didn't really come from outside because they're getting funded by the same people. And White House is basically, I don't know if he's doing it just for our benefit. Perhaps it could be in part for Amy Coney Barrett's benefit. But he is basically explaining something that is deeply, deeply corrupt in our system now. Money. And not only this mass amount of money that is going to, on one hand, spending tens of millions of dollars to make sure that Kavanaugh gets on the court, tens of million dollars that make sure that Amy Coney Barrett gets on the court, money that you cannot determine where it's from. Then also starts to feed up cases to these justices. And today in the hearing, White House said he is going to dig deeper into this. So keep your eyes open for that. All right, we got to take a break, say goodbye to many of you folks. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. If you're sticking around, we got the fun half The entire crew is going to be here. I'm going to step out, but Matt and Brendan and Jamie and old Matt will be here steering the ship. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. You also help. You also get the extra content. And what else? Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. What else do we have for you? Oh, AM Quickie. It's available in your inbox. Well, not in your inbox. Maybe we could do it that way where we could email it to people. But you can find it in the app at majorityapp.com, completely free, or you can just sign up for it through your other podcast app. Check it out. 7 minutes of headline news every morning. We will be back tomorrow. Make sure you check out Nomiki's show on youtube.com/the Nomiki show. I don't know who's going to be on today, but 3 p.m. You can check that out. Also, don't forget, Jamie's got the Antifada. You can find it at patreon.com/the Antifada. TMBS, Matt, and check out Matt Binder's show, Doomed. Stick around. We're going to go to the fun half, and you can join these guys there. Should we head in there?
Here we go.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.